hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is Dr. Peter McCullough, and welcome to the McCullough Report. Well, we might as well jump into it right now. If you can recall back through the Trump administration, there were many, many breaking news stories that came across the major media. In fact, I recall a Saturday Night Live skit where one of the actors said, "Please, no more breaking news." They couldn't tolerate any more of Trump's chaos in the White House. Well, we don't need to worry about Trump or even Biden for that matter. We have plenty of chaos simply with the medical state of affairs with respect to COVID-19 and the mass vaccination program. So let's jump into it. On Tuesday, April 13th, the US FDA and the CDC announced a pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccination program after six women ages 18 to 48 years old developed blood clots in the brain. The details are not readily available, but these are likely to be what's called cavernous venous thrombosis. One of them died and one of them was hospitalized critically ill. Approximately 7 million individuals had received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Now, this is in the backdrop of a current mass vaccination program where the total number of individuals who have received vaccination in the United States is approximately 60 million individuals. And here are the data, and I'm going to read them directly from the Adverse Event Reporting System provided by the Centers for Disease Control. So this is direct information. It's not disinformation, and it's not my opinion. These are the data I'm going to read to you, which are open, and they should be clearly made available to you through a variety of media, including the McCullough Report. So as of April 2nd, 2021, there were 56,869 reports made to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Now, in order to report an event, it's typically a healthcare worker who observes what happens with a patient after vaccination. Among these 56,869 reports, of those 60 million vaccinated, there were 2,342 deaths, 4,972 hospitalizations, 8,975 urgent care visits, 8,744 office visits, 412 cases of anaphylaxis or serious near-fatal allergic reaction, and 460 cases of Bell's palsy. This is a temporary or permanent paralysis of the face and a drooping eye. Additionally, there were 502 heart attacks, 84 miscarriages, 3,145 severe allergic reactions, and 321 cases of a low platelet count called thrombocytopenia. Now, if I was in your shoes right now, I'd say, listen, these numbers sound big, but there have been so many people vaccinated. Could this just be a chance? And is this what happens when we see and examine 60 million individuals? Well, I can tell you the vast majority of these reports occur on days 1, 2, and 3 after the vaccine. So they are temporally related to administer the vaccine. Again, they're reported by a concerned healthcare worker that's either given the vaccination, has seen the patient in the hospital or the clinic, or has seen the patient in a senior home or other domicile facility. And I can tell you by comparison, if we go back to 1976 and the swine flu pandemic, we attempted a mass vaccination program at that time. And there was approximately 55 million people vaccinated, so nearly the same amount as currently vaccinated for the COVID vaccine. At that time, there were approximately 500 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a form of paralysis that starts down the legs and starts to march up the body. And there were approximately 25 deaths. And the government officials at that time said, listen, we're going to pull it. The swine flu vaccine in 1976 is simply too dangerous to continue to administer for swine flu. You may ask the question, how can we be at 60 million people vaccinated? We've already had one vaccine paused, and we have 2342 deaths. We have basically a 100-fold greater number of deaths now with the COVID-19 vaccine than we did with the swine flu vaccine. Well, here's a little bit more information just to give you an idea about background rates of events and vaccines. We vaccinate approximately 195 million individuals in the United States per year. And there's roughly 20 to 30 individuals who are reported in the adverse event system to have died within 30 days or so of the vaccination. So about 195 million, 20 to 30 reported deaths. That could be, in a sense, a background rate. So whether we use the swine flu example or we use our yearly influenza vaccine example, we are far and away in the middle of the most deadly mass vaccination program in modern human history. And you're witnessing it right now. So the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which most doctors, including myself, believed was the most safe vaccine. I still believe that today. I believe it's the safest vaccine. It had the fewest number of safety reports. But of interest, Johnson & Johnson was the first one selected to be paused by the CDC and the US FDA. And it is a relatively similar vaccine to the AstraZeneca vaccine. Both of these vaccines are what's called adeno-associated virus vector vaccines. So they there is a DNA-based virus. It codes for the RNA of the spike protein of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And this adeno-associated viral vector must go into cells and, in a sense, infect the cells, dump off the payload of the DNA, which codes for the RNA of the spike protein. And that RNA then spins in your cells and produces the spike protein. And then your bodies respond to that by producing an immune response. That's how both the AstraZeneca and J&J vaccines work. Now, the J&J vaccine is derived from human cells, whereas the AstraZeneca virus is derived from chimpanzee cells. And I can tell you as a doctor, I really don't think it makes much of a difference where it's derived from. We do know that the adeno-associated viral vectors themselves have had prior reports of stimulating blood clotting or thrombosis. So I think that is one of the similarities there between the two vaccines. But we also know that generation of the spike protein in the COVID-19 illness directly leads to blood clotting. It leads to blood clotting in the lungs, major blood clots in the legs, in the brain, causing stroke, causing complete blockages of arteries to the heart and heart attacks. So we know the viral infection itself is what we call thrombogenic. Now, the J&J vaccine paused in the U.S. on April 13th. The U.S. government had already pre-purchased 300 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for $1.2 billion. So we had already bought enough Johnson & Johnson to massively vaccinate the U.S. population. We'd also simultaneously purchased a tremendous amount of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine. So if you actually look at the backup plan for the U.S. purchase of these vaccines, these early stage vaccines, we have made a massive investment in vaccination. The companies have already received their money, if you will. And in fact, the J&J is out of the picture currently. Now, the AstraZeneca vaccine on March 16th was already pulled from 18 different markets in Europe. It never was approved in the United States or hasn't come up yet for emergency use authorization. It was close to us in Canada, and the AstraZeneca vaccine, when it was rolled out in Canada, the initial plan was not to vaccinate individuals over age 65 because of the concern that there simply wasn't enough efficacy or safety data. And with the recent reports that came in, not only from Europe, but also Canada, The Canadian authorities recently restricted the AstraZeneca vaccine to no one below age 50. So here we are in the middle of the pandemic and in the middle of the mass vaccination program with a lot of news to digest. And I can tell you as a doctor, my phone has never rang so much regarding vaccine questions. And one of the things that doctors and other providers really need is we need a straight story from the federal government on vaccines, and we really need it now. You're listening to the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. Well, let's pick up on vaccines and understand a bit more about them, since there seems to be basically no shortage of news regarding vaccines. Well, the first thing is about news itself. On December 10th, the Trusted News Initiative was announced, the TNI. And the TNI was a broad-based collaboration of media and social media that had a goal of filtering out any information that was judged to be false or misleading regarding vaccines. And the reason why the Trusted News Initiative was announced, it had a laudable goal, and the goal was to reduce vaccine hesitancy. And vaccine hesitancy means people becoming a bit frightened regarding vaccines and maybe opting not to take vaccines because they're frightened about them. So there was a thought here with the Trusted News Service that Big Brother, if you will, or government or the media, that they know better than the individual on the street, the common person, and in fact, information should be filtered. Now, YouTube announced very recently that they were going to go ahead and take some extra steps and actually go through what's available on YouTube and make a judgment with respect to the videos and the information, and go ahead and scrub any of the videos that would create hesitancy with respect to vaccines. So you can imagine a report like this, which is simply giving the news regarding adverse event reporting and vaccines. A radio program like this, if it was put on YouTube, would be scrubbed instantaneously. It would be viewed as being leading an individual towards vaccine hesitancy. Well, I can tell you myself, my family members, my patients, the first thing they want to know is the straight story. They want to know what is the accurate information. And all I can tell you is that the accurate information are the CDC data. And I've just read that to you. That's information. Now, it's not misinformation. It's not like I gave the wrong numbers. Those numbers I read to you directly out of the database. And I didn't necessarily give you my opinion. I didn't tell you if it was safe or unsafe. I just gave you the numbers. And then I gave you a reference point. I gave you an opportunity to compare that to the swine flu pandemic and mass vaccination in a similar number of Americans. And I gave you another number, which was the annual influenza vaccine rate and what's reported there. So what we're left with is we're left with the possibility that everyone is just on pins and needles regarding COVID-19, and that anything and everything that happens with these vaccines is being reported to the adverse event reporting system. Or we're dealing with a pretty frightening situation that the next injection of either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine could be a potentially fatal decision for the individual who receives it. And there is a tremendous amount of conversation out there. Doctors, healthcare systems, and others are very worried about being labeled anti-vax, that you're an anti-vaxxer, that one is kooky or has odd views regarding vaccines or conspiracies regarding vaccines. Others have said, listen, we're not anti-vax. In fact, we all get our vaccines and our kids get our vaccines, but the vaccines are judged to be safe and effective, and they have a track record. And here we have the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines They have only had 2 months of observation after their introduction on the market. They use a brand new technology. We know during that observation period that the rates of COVID in those who received the vaccine and those who received placebo was less than 1% over 2 months. So we know very few people were exposed to COVID during the vaccination program. And now we're administering this in the broader public with the idea that maybe more individuals would get exposed to COVID. And so we are very much thirsting for real world evidence or information about what's happening when patients do receive these vaccines. So some information has come forward recently from a variety of sources, and I want to point you to one that was recently published. The first author is Kustin, K-U-S-T-I-N, Talia Kustin, and this comes from the Shimunis School of Biomedicine and Cancer Research at the George S. Wise Faculty of Life Sciences in Tel Aviv University, Tel Aviv, Israel. And the title of the paper is Evidence for Increased Breakthrough Rates of SARS-CoV-2 Variants of Concern in the BNT162B2 Messenger RNA Vaccinated Individuals. That is code word for the Pfizer vaccine. So Israel, as you may know, is a country that was ahead of other countries with respect to vaccination. Israel is a divided country, if you will. It's composed of the entire circumscribed borders of Israel contain about 20% of individuals who live in the Palestinian territories. So they are Palestinians and they are not citizens of Israel. Another 20% who are Israeli Arabs, so they actually are citizens of Israel. They're under the rule of the Israeli government. And then the remaining 60% are Israelis. And the majority of them obviously came from outside the Middle East and during the nation building of Israel, built that population of kind of newly landed Israelis in Israel. That's the population of Israel. They're currently at about 50% of individuals vaccinated. And what Kustin found in this group of individuals, that the vaccine efficacy rate was much less than expected. And in fact, these variants could break through. And in fact, they did break through. And of concern were a variety of these different strains that the Israelis are now coming in contact with. But the estimates are that as opposed to a 90% protection, in fact, the protection is going to be less than that over time. Now, another paper has been published from Denmark, and that paper also has been carefully evaluated in terms of breakthrough. And the first author is Helms, Mustin Helms, and the title of the paper is Vaccine Effectiveness After First and Second Doses, again, of the BNT162B2 mRNA Vaccine in Long-Term Care Facilities in Denmark. And what they found among 39,040 long-term care facility residents, so this is more patients than were even vaccinated in the Pfizer trial, that beyond the 7 days of the second dose, the vaccine efficacy or protection was approximately 64% in the residents of the nursing homes, about 90% in the workers, which is good. But it's certainly far from what the average American thinks in terms of protection after the Pfizer vaccine. I anticipate the Moderna vaccine will be similar. Now, the group at Stanford University has investigated the code for the spike protein of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine. And I'm told by very good sources that that code is not identical. So the Pfizer-Moderna vaccines are slightly different, modified to try to reduce what's considered the reactogenicity of the vaccine, what type of severe reactions that it could form. But having said that, it's great concern that the efficacy of the Pfizer-Moderna vaccines may not be at 90%. and they may be vulnerable to the variants. And I won't get you too caught up in variants, whether it's the variant from Great Britain or the variant from Brazil or South Africa. Keep in mind that about 6 to 8 different strains have always been circulating in the United States, that the vaccines were all coded for or modeled after the original Wuhan virus, so-called wild-type virus. And so all of these strains, while the immunity to the wild-type virus may hold up fine against various strains, the concern is if the immunity is too similar from individual to individual, the virus will continue to mutate and, in a sense, find its way past the immunized individual. And that may be what we're seeing at this point in time. You're listening to the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Radio. Well, I wanted to spend a few minutes before our break regarding this idea of data, of information, misinformation, and opinion, because I was targeted, if you will, in the last few weeks, in the last few days, concerning this. And I wanted to just give you my personal perspective. I'm a doctor, and I'm considered an expert in medicine. It's not uncommon that I would be asked to make a presentation before the FDA or the European Medical Association or the New York Academy of Sciences. So I'm not new at this. I've made presentations to the Congressional Oversight Panel, to the National Institutes of Health, and have spent my time on TV. I was called before the U.S. Senate on November 19th to testify regarding how COVID should be treated early at home to reduce hospitalization and death. I was called by the Texas Senate on March 10th of this year to give a report about what we've learned in the pandemic and how we can do better moving forward. And of course, videos are made after each one of these. On March 31st, I was called before the Colorado General Assembly to more specifically mention how doctors use drugs off-label and appropriately so to treat COVID-19 early. And then on April 14th, I testified in front of the New Hampshire Senate. And I can tell you that on several occasions now, I've seen ugly pictures presented on social media. I saw one from the Texas Senate testimony where it's a picture of me testifying there. And there's a giant red X over me that says that I've been fact checked and indicates that I have given incorrect facts. Well, let me state that when individuals are called to testify at these different venues, we raise our right hand, we're sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help us God. And then we're asked to render our opinions. We are not there to spew facts. The facts can always be checked and evaluated. So if I gave a number, that can always be checked. That can be fact checked. But what the committee and the U.S. public wants is my opinion as a doctor. So I gave my opinions as a doctor. And I recently went over this very carefully with Christina Borgeson of the Whistleblowers. And we went through a report that came out on French media. So to give you an idea, the French are really watching what's going on in Austin, Texas. That's pretty neat. Rémy Bennett, he's the one who published the hit job on fact-checking. And we went through each one of his claims. And of course, I had very good support in the literature for each one of those claims. And we produced a very careful recording of each one of those points. So it wasn't about incorrect facts. It wasn't about misinformation. I was rendering my opinion. And when it comes to science and medicine, that's all that doctors can do is we generate opinions based on information we see. It's called inferential thinking. It's very different than engineering. Engineering it uses deductive thinking, and it uses principles that keep airplanes in the air. Engineering keeps buildings from falling over. In the world of medicine, we use inferential thinking, meaning we never really know the truth. We're trying to get closer to truth by using various information and trying to analyze it. So we rely on biostatistics heavily in our field. We also rely heavily on publication and peer review and multiple different publications to ultimately kind of zero in on the right idea. And you may have been frustrated through the course of your medical listening to various reports. Well, you hear something, chocolate's good for you. Now the next report, chocolate's bad for you. And you may ask, well, how can that be? Well, it's because we're looking at different sources of data with different types of analyses and trying to come up with conclusions. So one of the statements that I made in the Texas Senate had to deal with asymptomatic spread of the virus. And I made the comment that it's my opinion that very little spread of SARS-CoV-2 occurs from asymptomatic individuals. And that was my understanding of the literature. And the fact-checking French reporter stated that that was incorrect. And so I reviewed this carefully, and there are two now very good papers. One is by Cao, C-A-O, and the other one's by Madewell, M-A-D-E-W-E-L-L, that clearly show when we do detailed contact tracing and detailed testing for the virus in the nose and detailed genetic sequencing to make sure the virus is really there, and then ask people who they came in contact with and who got sick, and we follow up. We do the best of all possible work. Both of those studies show in far more than 10 million individuals that less than 1% of all the spread is related to asymptomatic spread. Both of those papers, they're contemporary papers in the last 6 months. Now, why would the CDC or doctors claim that 30 or 40 or 50% of spread is by asymptomatic individuals? Because that argument is being used that we need to vaccinate teenagers and children. We need to vaccinate babies down to 7 months old because they could asymptomatically carry it. Where would that information come from? Well, there are papers that say 30, 40, 50, 60% of spread is asymptomatic, but they are papers that are based on models. So they make assumptions. So one of the classic assumptions is a patient is asymptomatic for 3 to 5 days before symptoms evolve. So when we do the math on who they could have come in contact and we do a big set of hypothetical calculations, we can come up with a number of, let's say, 50% for asymptomatic spread. But the models here, as you can imagine, it's kind of like a weather forecast model. Sometimes the forecast isn't too good. In fact, we've had models concerning COVID-19. One of them comes from University of Washington, so-called Murray model. And many of you have been probably frustrated with this, where the Murray model has predicted something's going to happen. The pandemic has been completely wrong. One of the great examples of the Murray model, and I published an opinion editorial on this in The Hill last year, had to deal with forecasting where the critical medical care needs were going to be. So the Murray model predicted that in the spring that Dallas, Texas was going to be absolutely overwhelmed with COVID-19. It was going to be the next New York City. So immediately the Army National Guard was called in. It was called into the K. Bailey Hutchison Convention Center. They made the whole convention center an Army camp, and there were beds set up and IV fluids and ventilators. And it went on and on and on in the spring in Dallas, Texas. And I can tell you, this is where I live. I could literally ride a bicycle down there to the convention center. I can tell you for a fact, not a single patient was treated in the Dallas Convention Center for COVID-19, not a one. So what does that tell you? That tells you that models are theoretical prediction devices. They're not reality. Don't rely on them. When we have hard data that comes in that says less than 1% of all the spread is asymptomatic, that's good enough to operate on. What does that mean? That means we don't need to be putting nasal swabs up people's noses who have no symptoms. We don't need to be swabbing people who are visiting their relatives in nursing homes or NBA players who are just trying to get through a season. We don't need to be swabbing people before they go into the Capitol building. We know asymptomatic people fundamentally account for very little spread. I think if the best advice is if someone feels like they're coming down with a cold or has some nasal stuffiness, hold themselves out of an activity. I can tell you at my hospital, what's done is we say have a simple temperature checker. We don't want people coming in with a hot fever where they would be obviously very contagious. And I just went through that today at the hospital. I went in, got my temperature checked, went about my work, not a big deal. So we've heard the words follow science, data, information, misinformation, and opinion. What I'm concerned about is straight up data is being labeled as misinformation, and that opinions are being subject to fact-checking. Opinions are just opinions. You'll get different ones from different people. So we'll get into this a little bit more when we return on the other side of our break. You're listening to the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Now, never before in our history have we witnessed the level of hatred that is now being waged against our law enforcement. While anarchist groups create havoc and overwhelm our first responders, these same groups and their corporate supporters are calling for the police forces to be shrunk and defunded. What can you and I do to make a difference? How can we stand up for what is right and to show our support? That's what I'm going to tell you about this incredible new platform. It's called ShopToTheRight.com. And it's a new shopping platform that will help you find businesses that align with your values. They feature products made in America. They support veteran-owned businesses, as well as our law enforcement community. This is a time when we need to stick together. We need to shop together, and we need to support each other. It's time for you and I to make some noise and stand up to protect our country. And one easy way to do that is to shop and give our money to companies that don't seek to destroy our way of life. So join the fight for liberty. ShopToTheRight.com. Support those American businesses that support law enforcement and veterans.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
There was a time when Americans could rely on the Fourth Estate. Well, in these challenging times, the media is both reckless and complicit. AmericaOutloud.com. Top analysis from leading experts, articles, podcast, video, and 24/7 talk radio. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Pick up on this issue of data, information, misinformation, and opinion. So I had the pleasure this week of testifying in the New Hampshire Senate. And what was on the docket, among many things in the New Hampshire Senate, was a House bill. It had already been passed by the House in New Hampshire. And it dealt with the issue of the principle of autonomy. The principle of autonomy states, it's a fundamental medical ethical principle. It's written into the what's called Nuremberg Code and the Belmont Code. These are principles by which we act in medicine. And the principle of autonomy says that nothing can happen to your body against your will. And you can listen to advice and you can get input from doctors and other people, but nothing can be done to your body against your will. You cannot be pressured, coerced, nor can you be subject to reprisal if you decline that intervention. Okay. And so this is very important. Remember, coercion can mean that, you know, someone's really forcing you to do it. Coercion can be other sources of coercion. So I'll give an example. This COVID-19 vaccine, you know, many are understanding that it's brand new technology. It's under emergency use authorization. The consent form involves indemnification, meaning you give up all your liability rights to the vaccine manufacturer who administers it. Your information goes into a database. You really lose control of a lot when you consent for one of these vaccines. And so many have reservations, obviously. Many others have come forward and said, give me the vaccine. I can't take any more of this COVID pandemic. So people have divergent views. Well, Houston Methodist Hospital, the Texas Medical Center, announced last month that it was going to give a financial reward for those who underwent vaccination. It wasn't a small amount of money. It was $500. Well, that would be considered coercion. If we had a research study at my hospital, and we said, you know what, if you'll be in research, we'll give you $500. Do you want to sign up? That actually wouldn't be approved by our investigation review board that operates upon the Nuremberg Code. It would say that's coercive. You can't do that. You can't waive $500 in front of somebody who really could need it and say, here, take this vaccine. So that's coercion. We've already seen things kind of go wrong, but it doesn't stop there. We heard, I mean, one of the reasons why I was testifying in the New Hampshire Senate is we had already heard about plans that there were going to be decisions made on who could travel, who could go to school, who could be employed in what capacity, who could stay in a nursing home or assisted living facility, all based on if they received the COVID-19 vaccine. This is unprecedented to have a vaccine, in a sense, kind of separate individuals, especially a vaccine that's only partially effective. I've told you plenty of people get COVID anyway who get the vaccine, so it's not like it's makes much of a difference one person to another. It's partially effective. And I've already told you that the vaccines are loaded with safety concerns. But this is unprecedented. And I can tell you, I did it. I testified in the Senate, and I listened to senators. And some senators took the viewpoint that if a private business wanted to have all their customers have the vaccine before they went into a private business, that they had the right to do so. And so you can imagine if you're a customer and you want that product, but you can't even go into the store unless you're vaccinated, that may be a form of coercion or pressure. You may actually need what's in that store. There were others who the biggest issue they had up on the board, and this is recorded and all on YouTube, the biggest issue is they wanted to attend the graduation of a university in New Hampshire. And that graduation was contemplating mandating everybody who attended having received the vaccine. So somebody asked, listen, if we pass this, would this protect us from having the vaccine forced on us for us to attend our kids' graduation? And it was a legal opinion said, yes, that would be one of the things that the legislation would do. I can tell you as an expert, I testified that the virus is clearly treatable. The vaccines are only partially effective. And then I read the same exact vaccine safety data into the record for the New Hampshire Senate. I read it just like I did to you today. There was a representative from one of the government departments who testified right after me, and she said, you heard a lot of misinformation today from Dr. McCullough. A lot of misinformation. I can tell you, I'm deeply concerned. When we get to the point where we have the world's experts reading data from a government database and having another government official come up afterwards and state that that data represents misinformation, we're in trouble. When we're at that stage, we can't discern between what's reality, the data that anybody can go on the CDC website and see, and then this person's statement, which states that it's misinformation. So I think the word disinformation, misinformation, and fake news, and I'll give Trump credit for fake news, I can tell you, I think this is one of the most dangerous developments of all time, because the listeners or the viewers, we can't tell. And we're to the point where we really can't tell unless we see it for ourselves. We really can't know. And you can imagine if we have a trusted news service or we have YouTube and social media scrubbing any information out there that could be negative, what are we going to be left with? We're going to be left with only positive information. We're going to have the thoughts, in a sense, put into our brain that the COVID-19 vaccine is perfectly effective and perfectly safe. That is going to be the message. So I had another experience this week. I had a chance to deliver a lecture at the American College of Clinical Genetics. And the chairman of our session was Dr. Anthony Gregg, who's considered one of the leading medical geneticists in the world. He's an obstetrician gynecologist. And he took a courageous topic for this college session. And it had to do with COVID-19 repurposing of drugs and vaccination. And there were three speakers, myself, and then two that were oriented towards the vaccine. And my role was to present on early treatment. And it was really quite an interesting experience. And I'll pick up on that in just a minute. You're listening to the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Radio. So at the American College of Clinical Genetics this week, my presentation was a simple one. It had to do with our work building on signals of benefit, acceptable safety, using drugs in combination to reduce hospitalizations and death by approximately 85%. Now, it's not a perfect science. It's well ahead of any large randomized clinical trials of using multiple drugs in COVID-19. And in fact, I can tell you those trials are not forthcoming. But I did have a chance to pick up on the fireworks afterwards. And when I made the comment that the virus is clearly treatable, and I made the comment now that some of the patients that we're treating are vaccine failures. In fact, they've had the vaccine and they turn around and get the virus. Oh my Lord, the vaccine stakeholders went hard, and the word effective and the word safe came out of their mouths over and over again. It was almost like information was being put there in words. And again, I went to the CDC data and I just read the data. I read a data just like I did to you, because I wanted the audience to hear the data. I said, it's not opinion. It's not misinformation. It's exactly the information. And let you, the listener, judge if it's safe. Let you, the listener, judge if it's effective. If I'm telling you that more than half of my COVID patients right now have received the vaccine, you know, I'm giving you a signal that, in fact, it's very possible that if you take the COVID-19, you could end up with COVID anyway. And you could be very disappointed, potentially, that you took the risks of taking the vaccine and you ended up with COVID. I can tell you many of my patients are in that predicament, like, gosh darn it, why did I take the vaccine? But I was challenged recently by a patient who had taken either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, and it was basically within a week or so, sure enough, that person came down with COVID-19. Now, she came home, and of interest, her father had just taken the J&J vaccine, and sure enough, he got COVID within a week of the J&J vaccine. The mother, who was skeptical, she held back and didn't take any one of the vaccines. And so here we are, we have three people in the family with COVID-19. And so I looked into this, and on page 42 of the Pfizer FDA application that was presented to the vaccine board for emergency use authorization, on page 42, there is a report of interest that there's a much larger number of people who receive the vaccine compared to placebo who present in the next 2 weeks with COVID-19. In fact, there is an enhancement, if you will, of the susceptibility to COVID-19. And the paper I've already mentioned from Israel showed the same thing in real life. We don't know the data on J&J, but it does raise the specter that the vaccine may temporarily put an individual at increased risk than not having the vaccine at all, at least temporarily before immunity sets in. So I reached out to a immunologist, a vaccine developer. His degree is actually in veterinary medicine, but he spent his whole life with the Gates Foundation and other vaccine manufacturers, Dr. Geert Vandenbosch, and you'll see his name out in social media. I reached out to him concerning this possibility, and what he let me know is that it's conceivable that after the first dose, there is, in a sense, an immature library of early antibodies forming, and that the body is temporarily a little bit more susceptible from infection due to the real virus, which the antibodies are not yet formed to protect it against before a stronger immunity sets in with the second vaccination. So we'll pick up on that in just a minute with a few more comments. You're listening to the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. So in the last few minutes, I want to bring it home with respect to the whole vaccine situation. One of the things I was criticized for in the Texas Senate, and I can be criticized for it today, is my viewpoint on this, is that I think individuals under age 50 do not have a favorable risk-benefit ratio for the vaccine, meaning that under age 50, with no medical problems, if an individual gets COVID, there's less than a 1% chance of hospitalization and death. Now, with the vaccine, whether you get placebo or the vaccine, we know from the Pfizer-Moderna trials that the chances in the next 2 months of getting COVID-19 is less than 1%. So the question is, how much less than 1% can any individual really, in your life, really realize? You've got a less than 1%, less than 1%. And the principle here is less than 1% becomes infinitesimally low, that you really can't perceive it. You can't perceive it. So if we had guidelines, let's say for heart attacks, and we wanted to reduce heart attacks, the guidelines would say, listen, if you're less than 1%, you don't need to take aspirin or don't need to take cluster or Lorimson medicine. The rates are so low, you can't get lower than 1%. If you were to go for a major surgery, and the doctor said you have less than a 1% chance risk of complications, they would simply say, listen, go ahead with your surgery. You don't need to take any extra steps. So less than 1% is generally a signal that we're good. And in our first two manuscripts regarding how to treat COVID-19, we basically said, listen, when it gets less than 1%, even treatment can't improve upon that. And I think vaccination certainly can't. So I'll stick with that. Under age 50, less than 1% all the way around vaccine, simply can't have a benefit that would outweigh any risks. And these fatalities are not retrievable. And I think we're all on edge. We have 2342 deaths. They're clustering in the days 1, 2, and 3 with these vaccines. Watch out. And if it happens, obviously, in you or your loved ones, it's irretrievable. Now, over age 50, moving on up to age 75, individuals with a high contact job, let's say a hairdresser, barber, someone who's got a lot of people in and out, their contracting COVID-19 could start to have greater than 1% chance of hospitalization and death. And let's say there's some medical problems like obesity, diabetes, heart or lung disease. There's where the vaccine makes sense. So I received a ton of calls in the last few days from my patients in that zone, age 50 to 75, who received the J&J vaccine and said, what do I do? They were actually kind of upset that I recommended it. I said, listen, I recommended it because I thought it was safe. And I still do think it's the safest of all the vaccines. There's certainly been the fewest number of deaths with the J&J vaccine. I think it still is reasonable. So I'm not anti-vaxxer. I think an individual in that zone who has not had COVID-19, so they're susceptible. They're obviously over 50, so they're not pregnant or childbearing. I think we're good. You can have the vaccine. If there's no history of severe vaccine reactions or allergic reactions, we ought to be good. And the vaccine there has a positive benefit to risk relationship. Now, it's not perfect. There will be breakthrough infections, but I think overall that age group is reasonable. It's medically reasonable. Reasonable doctors would say that. Now, how about over age 75? I said, well, it kind of depends. Now, in the vaccine event reporting system, a large fraction of the deaths have occurred in the seniors. And a typical narrative would be a senior in a senior home gets the vaccine, 10 a.m., by the evening time develops fever, chills, nausea, vomiting, difficulty breathing, next day found dead in bed. That would be a pretty typical scenario that we'd see in the event reporting system. And there, it's possible that the immune reaction itself to the vaccine is so sufficiently powerful, it's basically life-threatening. Almost like COVID-19 would be. I've seen patients develop COVID-19 within a day or two and die because the infection is so severe. So it's possible that the messenger RNA vaccines simply are too strong for the elderly. It causes too much of an immune reaction. We do know the antibodies that elevate after vaccination with these vaccines are much higher than the natural infection. So these vaccines really do kind of juice the system, and they're not for the faint of heart. So keep that in mind. So seniors, I can tell you in my family circle, I have an 81-year-old, an 87 and 97. I am agonizing over the decision if they should be vaccinated. I know if they get COVID, it's going to be really serious. But I also couldn't forgive myself if they got the vaccine and that was their final medical decision and we couldn't retrieve it. So I'm personally agonizing over that decision. I know in some countries, they simply said, listen, we're just going to draw a line at some age. And it's just there's a frailty issue here in whether we don't have enough data or we have too much of a concern. They're just going to draw a line. So we're trying to find our way forward with the first modern day mass vaccination program. And we have seen just, I think, the tip of the iceberg. And I will predict over the next several months, we are going to see vaccine news and vaccine encouragement and stories morning, noon, and night on the media. And then we're going to be inundated with continued reports about what the social response should be to the vaccine. Vaccine passports, whether or not someone is stripped of medical insurance, whether they cannot be employed, whether they have to be marked. There's already been discussions of marking people. So for instance, if a nursing home resident doesn't take the vaccine, that nursing home resident has to wear a certain colored gown. There's already been discussions in healthcare that those who get vaccinated get liberated from the masks, but those who don't get a vaccine still have to wear masks. What's left out of this whole mass vaccination program is COVID-recovered patients. Now, keep in mind here, these patients have suffered with COVID-19. They've already had the illness. They already have robust, complete, and durable immunity. They have immunity to the spike protein, just like the vaccinated do, but they also have immunity from the nucleocapsid and all the other components of the virus. And we just have not seen hundreds of thousands of people back in the hospital on the mechanical ventilator over and over again with COVID-19. Even the most casual layperson just watching this would get the idea that you just don't get COVID-19 twice. And that's basically true with the SARS-CoV-1 virus, which is 80% similar to SARS-CoV-2 virus. The immunity there is at least 17 years ago. That's when it was. And so we have data now, at least observationally, that you don't get it twice. Any reports that I've reviewed where someone claims that patients have got it twice is just misinterpreting one of these false positive PCR tests. It's not two separate serious illnesses. So I do believe that COVID-recovered patients have robust, complete, and durable immunity, meaning, this is my judgment, this is not the CDC or anyone else's, my opinion. If a COVID-recovered patient never wore a mask again and just went back to usual life, I would anticipate, it's my opinion, that in fact they'd be perfectly fine. Today, I visited a clinic in Dallas from a doctor who's very well known in this area for being an early innovator. She was one of the first doctors to treat patients face-to-face in her clinic. While many other doctors turned patients away, she faced them face to face in her clinic. And I respectfully wore a mask. I walked in. I was careful. I had to wait, so I got on my computer. And she came out and down the hallway, and she says, you know, we don't wear masks here. And it was her decision. It's her clinic. It's her building. Texas removed the mask mandate. She had made her decisions not to wear a mask. It was actually the first time I'd been in a healthcare facility where we weren't wearing a mask, but that was her decision. And then we revealed later on, we discussed things, and in fact, you know, COVID, we agreed COVID recovered patients can't indeed get COVID-19. So we have a lot more to learn. Clearly, those of you out there are COVID recovered. I think you're in the best of all circumstances. Those of you who have had the vaccine, don't panic. You're fine. You've gotten through it. And you're going to have partial, hopefully even more complete immunity as things move on. But don't get too confident, because COVID-19 can't break through. And for those of you who have not yet had the vaccine, please carefully sift through the information, including this report and others that you're going to see out there. There's a very important data source. It's called OpenVAERS, OpenVAERS, and it basically is a one click away, and you can get an update on the safety events coming in. And keep in mind that the CDC, the US FDA, the National Institutes of Health, Pfizer and Moderna, J&J, AstraZeneca, White House Task Force, major media, trusted news service, they can be considered vaccine stakeholders, meaning they have a stake in mass vaccination, meaning they want to see this happen to close out the pandemic, because they hold the belief that this is the pathway to closing out the epidemic. But keep in mind, a stakeholder cannot be unbiased. That means they have a stake in the outcome. And so we'll pick up on this in future issues of the McCullough Report. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great week. And tune in next week when we tackle the next emerging breaking news in healthcare. And we'll go over this in great detail in the McCullough Report. And feel free to let me know your opinions as well out there on anything you've heard today. For now, I'll sign off and have a great rest of the week. You've been listening to the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.